Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. In a few minutes, we'll hear from former Republican Bruce Bartlett on the cast of ghouls who make up the GOP. And then towards the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with economist Jared Bernstein about income and poverty in 2011 and the composition of Romney's 47%. First, a few words on the recently suspended Chicago teacher strike. Last June, on my blog and on this show, I complained about how the insularity of many public sector unions gave organized labor a very bad image and contributed to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's defeat of the recall effort launched against him. As I argued at the time, the unions made his work too easy by looking too protective of their own advantages and not doing enough to organize more broadly in the interest of the general population. The Chicago Teachers Union was not like that at all. It made it clear that it was fighting for better schools for all. Although legally constrained against striking over non-wage issues, the union embraced a broad agenda in the public interest and was rewarded with strong public support. On their return to work, they made sure that textbooks would be available on the first day of classes. They're often not available for weeks. And they secured the hiring of new special ed teachers. Chicago Teachers Union showed public sector unions around the country how to go into a fight with the public on your side. Although the CTU is led by a fresh, militant team, I hope other public sector unions around the country study their example. My first guest today is Bruce Bartlett. Bartlett will review his long experience with the Republican Party at the beginning of this interview, so there's no point in my recounting it. But in recent years, he's found his former political home a very unwelcoming place. Bruce Bartlett. Welcome, Bruce. First, let's review your history with the Republican Party. You started in politics with Jack Kemp years ago?
No, actually, I started with Ron Paul even before that. Ron was elected the first time in a special election in 1976, and I went to work for him. But unfortunately, he was defeated the same year, and that was when I went to work for Jack Kemp. And after that, I worked on the New York State governor's race in 1978 for a guy named Perry Duryea. He was defeated. I came back to Washington and worked for newly elected senator named Roger Jepson from Iowa. And then I was on the Joint Economic Committee staff for several years, and I worked for Jude Winiski, whom you may know, for a year. Worked at the Heritage Foundation for a couple of years, worked in the last 2 years of the Reagan administration in the White House on the Office of Policy Development staff. And then I spent 4 years at Treasury during the George H.W. Bush administration, and that was my last government service.
Well, let's go back to the Kemp era. Jack Kemp certainly had politics different from mine, but he seemed genuinely to care about poor people. And to someone looking at today's Republican Party, Kemp's sympathy for poor folks seems almost quaint.
That's true. They simply don't care anymore. I think one of the defining characteristics of today's Republican Party that has been most evident, obviously, in the Romney video is just the absolute callousness towards the poor. And I think that this comes basically from Ayn Rand. I really do. The dominant view in the Republican Party is that every single person who's poor deserves to be poor because they're lazy and shiftless, and we should not waste any time on them. The idea that people could just be suffering from bad luck or circumstances beyond their control just seems to be absolutely foreign to them.
Going back to the Republican Party you knew in the 70s, 80s, into the 90s, was that a dominant feeling or has something changed?
Oh, I think something unquestionably changed. Remember that the Republican convention in 1980 was held specifically in an overwhelmingly black city, Detroit, because Republicans in those days were trying, perhaps incompetently, but they were trying to explain to poor and to minorities that they should be receptive to the Republican message, which and they really did believe as Jack Kemp used to say all the time, he used to repeat that line of Jack Kennedy's, that a rising tide lifts all boats, and they did believe that, and tried to explain why that was the case. And I think perhaps there was more plausible argument at that time that Republican policies would have a broader positive effect, including on the downtrodden. Today they don't seem to care.
Well, what happened?
Well, a lot of things happened, but I think one of the most pernicious is Karl Rove had a theory. Well, first of all, the history of politics, at least in the Republican Party, has always been that you run to the right during primaries, and then you run to the left in the general election, that is to say, towards the center, in order to win. But Rove had this theory that was bullshit. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, the way you really want, another way you could win anyway, was not to attract moderates at all, but rather to raise the turnout among Republican voters. As you know, for both Republicans and Democrats, only about half the people who identify with their parties actually vote on Election Day. And Rove had this theory that if you could just raise the turnout of people who already agree with you by a couple of percentage points, you could win the election that way. And the problem with that is to raise the turnout, you have to just constantly, you know, hype issues and frighten your voters and just use basically propaganda techniques all the time to keep them, you know, at a high state of concern that is very easily transformed into hatred. And that's really been the Republican model for the last 10 years is, you know, just get the crazies out there and get them to vote, and we can win without any votes whatsoever from moderates or undecideds or Reagan Democrats. Remember, Reagan had a substantial number of Democrats who he was able to win over to voting for him. Today, Republicans don't care anything about those people.
Of course, like him or not, Rove has a reputation as a genius. Is that misapplied?
Well, it worked for Bush, let's face it, but it didn't work for McCain. Perhaps McCain was not willing to pander to the right-wing crazies to the extent that was necessary, although clearly putting Sarah Palin on the ticket with him was a move in that direction. And I suspect that Romney is ill-suited to that sort of thing as well. They're just not as willing to lie and just say, well, although, I mean, you know, there's constant evidence against that as well. I think Romney's problem is he's just fundamentally a plutocrat. He really only cares about rich people. He knows how to appeal to them. He has no common touch. He has no ability to appeal to the core Republican voters who are basically Bible thumpers and gun nuts and anti-abortion crazies and people of that sort. And so I think he's probably going to lose. I just think he simply doesn't have the capability of hyping these issues to the extent that would be necessary for him to win.
But when he won the primary, he was thought to be, you know, the most presentable of all the candidates, the most sane and the most potentially able of attacking towards the center for a general election. Was that a misperception? Why?
Well, I think you have to remember that in the primaries we were, you know, we have to grade on a curve, and the curve includes truly whacked out people like Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain and Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann and Rick Santorum. Now, clearly, among people who are certifiably insane, the guy who's only half crazy is going to look better by comparison. And I think there's, to the extent there's any moderate element left in the Republican Party, I think that a lot of these people thought that Romney was just playing play-acting as a right-winger, and that he's, in his core, truly the moderate who governed the state of Massachusetts. I think one of the people who believes that, or believed that until very recently, is David Brooks, who I think has finally thrown up his hands and decided that there is no real Mitt Romney. He's just whatever he happens to say at the moment. And so I think that, you know, looking at that curve, Romney was the most moderate, for some odd reason, he has not made any effort whatsoever to move towards the center, which was the logical thing for him to do, given his record. And I don't really understand why. He's still out there beating the bushes to try to turn out the base, but I just don't think he has the skill to do it. And I think that's one reason why he's going to lose the election.
Yeah, when the 47% video came out, his reaction was rather uncritical. I mean, he just sort of stuck with it, toned down the language a little bit, but he pretty much embraced the content of it. Did his reaction surprise you at all?
It's consistent with the way he has run his campaign. I think even more revealing was the way he reacted to the Libya disaster, where instead of rallying around the country and saying we need to unify at a time of crisis, he had this ridiculous attack on the president that was just a plain lie, and he just absolutely adamantly refused to deny that it was to admit that it was a lie, just as he's refused consistently to admit that he's been lying about the welfare reform business as well. He just seems to have gotten into this idea that lying is his key to victory, which I don't think is going to work. But the people on his side are very uncritical. They accept these lies as the truth because they hear them day after day after day on Fox News, and it's I call it self brainwashing. I don't really know what else to call it.
Of course, we recall Eugene McCarthy's famous remark about Mitt Romney's father, that he didn't need a brainwashing, just a light rinse would do.
Actually, I haven't heard that before, but it makes sense. As you know, or as maybe the audience doesn't know, his father was famously lost the non-Republican nomination in 1968 because he said he had been brainwashed about Vietnam, probably the most ill-chosen words in political history.
Well, but now his son seems to be trying to steal the title from him. But you described the base of the Republican Party in pretty gruesome terms a little while ago. It's just like bigots and lunatics of various sorts. How did this happen? How did this major party in the most powerful country in the world get hijacked by a truly appalling set of bigots and lunatics?
Well, because they took over the region of our country that has been dominated for 200 years by bigots and lunatics, namely the South. And when they took over the South, when they replaced the Democrats as the party of the solid South, they picked up a lot of the cultural norms of that region, which include things like being, biblical literalists. And I've written about how the Southerners, who 150, 200 years ago were defending slavery on biblical grounds to protect themselves from the attacks by the abolitionists, and in fact it's quite true. You can go through the Bible and you will not find one single word condemning slavery, and you'll find many passages in which it says that slaves should honor their masters and things of this sort. So the Southerners adopted this very literal interpretation of the Bible for racist reasons, and that biblical literalism has carried over into a lot of other areas of our culture. And as we know, we had people like Rick Santorum, who were, now we have U.S. Senate candidates from, Missouri saying that rape is not rape, and, citing biblical passages and things of this sort. So a lot of it has to do with the Republican takeover of the South, which had been going on for a long time but wasn't completed until the mid-1990s. And I think ever since then, the South has become more and more dominant culturally and politically within the Republican Party, and the which is ironic because the party, as you know, was formed and based for a century in the northeast. And now I don't think there's a single, well, except for the two ladies from Maine, I don't think there are any Republicans left in the Northeast, and I think there's only one white Democrat left in the South. So we've just had a complete reversal of the geographical bases of both parties over the last 20 or 30 years.
I'm speaking with the Republican renegade Bruce Bartlett. But you might think that the Wall Street Fortune 500 wing of the party would exercise some grown-up supervision over the bigots and lunatics. Where are they? They just want to keep their taxes down?
That's actually the most interesting question about this whole this recent election cycle, is the extent to which the Wall Street people seem to be really, really aggressively anti-Obama. And when I've tried to figure out where this comes from, and they just seem to feel like he's hurt their feelings. He hasn't actually done any policies that hurt them. On the contrary, as you know, the stock market is up about 100% under his administration. And yet the antagonism and indeed the hatred of Obama among these Wall Street wealthy people is just, you know, very deep and very broad. And obviously Romney was pandering to that in his video, and I think it's important to understand that this was a sales video, so it can't be taken completely as Romney's own opinions, but rather as him telling his audience what he thought they wanted to hear, you see, because he was asking them for contributions. So one can interpret him as, in essence, summarizing the views of all the people in that audience of very, very ultra-wealthy people. And in some ways, that's even more appalling than the idea that he was simply expressing a personal opinion.
It has become a theme on the right that that 47% thing, right? They're freeloaders. They don't pay taxes.
Yeah,
there is a popular base from this, aside from
the thing about, you know, non-taxpayers has been around for a long time, but it's a bit of a change to kind of say, okay, if you're not paying they always say not paying taxes, which isn't true. It's not paying federal income taxes. But then they make the leap of saying, well, if you're not paying taxes, therefore it's the same as if you're on welfare. So they've kind of subtly switched the terminology to make it as if you're a freeloader simply by virtue of not paying federal income taxes. And of course the irony here is that the reason they don't pay federal income taxes has a lot to do with Republican tax policies. It was Gerald Ford's administration that created the earned income tax credit. It was greatly expanded by Ronald Reagan. The child credit, which was created during the George W. Bush administration, is another key reason why a great many people don't pay federal income taxes. So they're now attacking their own policies and saying, well, if you take advantage of Republican tax policies, you're on welfare. I mean, this is just crazy. I mean, you know, it's nuts.
And what about the other guy on the ticket? Ryan has a reputation as, like him or not, a serious budget wonk. Do you think that reputation's deserved?
Well, look, I know Paul, and he is a serious guy, or at least he likes to think he is, and is very earnest and wants to learn about things. But the idea that his plan is sort of the be-all and end-all of budget policy is just utter nonsense. Huge parts of the plan are simply made up. If you go to the Congressional Budget Office's analysis of the Ryan plan, it states clearly right in there on page one that they were ordered to accept certain assumptions that they could not analyze because there was no detail that would allow them to analyze it. The most important is that Ryan ordered the CBO, which he can do as chairman of the House Budget Committee, to assume that we would raise 19% of GDP in revenues because of his plan. Yet his plan contains, as Romney's does, a huge tax cut with no specification of what loopholes or base broadeners would be included to offset the revenue loss. And right now, revenues are only 16% of GDP. So he was, in essence, saying, we're going to reduce the deficit by 3% of GDP every single year because I'm just telling you that that's what we're going to do without telling you how. This is just utter gross intellectual dishonesty.
That's the power of faith for you. But now, the last few days we've seen, we almost forgot it now with the 47% video, but early in the week, Politico reported a lot of dissension in the Romney ranks and despair over the direction of the campaign. And, you know, we've seen very mainstream pundits like Mark Halperin, the Politico guys as well. Like, it seems to be despairing of Romney's possibilities to win this election, although the polls are still pretty close. Do you think that the polls are just going to catch up with this this sense of failure sometime soon?
I don't see any path that Romney has to the White House. You know, you always have to, you know, qualify that by saying, you know, as of today, and who knows what will happen in the next 6 weeks. His only real opportunity will be in the debates, and there's simply no evidence in history that the debates make that much difference, although you never can tell, right? So I just don't see how, and perceptions don't change very radically at this point in the election cycle. All he has left is a lot of money to run advertising, but it's been my observation that over a certain threshold, too much advertising actually becomes negative. That is, it hurts the person doing the advertising because people get sick and tired of seeing the same commercials over and over and over again, and that creates a backlash. So I don't see how Romney can win. And I think some of the people in his orbit are trying to distance themselves from his failure so that they're not tainted by it. And perhaps some, you know, have been giving him intelligent advice all along that he has been ignoring. I don't know. But this is the sort of thing that one tends to see in losing campaigns. It's starting earlier than it usually does, that's all.
And finally, you're still not going to vote for Obama.
No, as I said before, I have said, although I hate the Republicans, I simply don't have much respect for the Democrats. My main problem with them is that they simply don't seem to have the courage of their convictions. They allow the Republicans to treat them like dirt. They're very afraid to voice any opinion that will be criticized on Fox News. A few Democrats, you know, talk about the unemployed, but why aren't they talking about it 24/7? I mean, why aren't unemployed workers, you know, marching on Washington, demanding that something be done about jobs? Why didn't Democrats embrace the Occupy Wall Street movement the way the Republicans embraced and ultimately took over the Tea Party movement? It just, I mean, this goes beyond you know, political tactics. It just seems to me that Democrats are afraid of Republicans, and until they get over that fear and are willing to forthrightly put forward a philosophy that is consistent and with their ideals, and to try to pretend that they're really kind of moderate conservatives, which is essentially what Obama is. As you know, I've argued for a long time that Obama is essentially, looking at the political spectrum in historical terms, a moderate conservative. He's not really a liberal. And this is why the right-wing attacks on him for being a Marxist are so utterly ludicrous and over the top. We don't have any real leftists in our country anymore. We used to have some real honest-to-God socialists. There aren't any left in this country. There's nobody talking about government ownership of the means of production. There's nobody even talking about a government jobs program, for Pete's sakes. So until the left, you know, regains its courage, you know, I can't really be part of that group.
That was renegade Republican Bruce Bartlett. His most recent book, published earlier this year, is The Benefit and the Burden, Tax Reform, Why We Need It and What It Will Take. Another conservative renegade I had in this show a while back, David Frum, had an interesting analysis of Romney's 47% remarks in the Daily Beast. As Frum put it, the American upper class has been in the mood of apocalyptic terror during the Obama years, hallucinating that he's some sort of Marxist about to expropriate them, quoting from to give to his base of bums, as Charles Murray memorably put it. They're in this mood, even though Obama is very unthreatening, and there's no mass movement coming from the left. There was Occupy a year ago, and maybe it's coming back, but this is not Flint, 1936. More from Fromm. Quote, from the greatest crisis of capitalism since the 1930s, the rights and perquisites of wealth have emerged undiminished, and the central issue in this election is whether those rights and perquisites shall be enhanced still more, or whether they should be allowed to slip back to the level that prevailed during the dot-com boom. Yet even so, the rich and old are scared witless. End quote. Amazing, really. You have to wonder if they have a guilty conscience and therefore expect some sort of Jacobin wilding to begin imminently. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Boulez is Alive by Judd Greenstein, one of a group of young Brooklyn-based composers performed by Molly Markowski. Greenstein explains that the title is an allusion to an article called Schoenberg is Dead by Pierre Boulez, a denunciation of Schoenberg's lingering attachment to Romanticism, which struck modernists like Boulez as grossly sentimental. We'll hear some of the Boulez music that inspired the piece at the end of the show. Next up is Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. He served for a while as Vice President Joe Biden's economic advisor. Here he is to talk about income, poverty, and the 47%. Jared Bernstein. Welcome, Jared. First, just some comments on last week's income and poverty numbers. It doesn't feel much like a recovery, does it?
No, I mean, particularly you saw middle-class incomes take a hit in real terms. They fell about 1.5%, which is actually a pretty big drop in 1 year. And these are data for 2011. Interestingly, the poverty rate kind of held steady, 15%, which is actually quite elevated, again, as you'd expect coming out of such a deep recession. But we thought that was evidence of some of the safety net measures that kicked in and helped prevent poverty from going even higher. I think the other most notable point in the release was that where you do see incomes recovering are at the very top of the scale. By far, the largest gains went to the wealthiest families.
And it was the over 65 households also helped sustain the average, didn't they?
Right. I mean, the story there is basically if you are insulated from recession, you did a lot better. So if you're at the very top of the income or wealth scale, the kinds of increases on unemployment and losses of wealth hurt you a lot less. And in fact, the part of the recovery that's the part of the economy, I should say, that's recovered quickest is the corporate profitability. If you were in the middle of the income scale, where there's less policy pointed in your direction right now, you did worse. And interestingly, for low-income people, many of the safety net measures that kicked in have been helping them. So I wrote an analysis of the Poverty Day numbers that was called Policy Matters. It's basically arguing that who we've tried to kind of help has done better, and who we've ignored has done worse.
But we have seen recovery in the job market. We're 2 years these numbers were 2 years beyond the official end of the recession. We're now 3 years beyond it. Yet we don't really see much of a recovery in incomes. Well, what's holding it back?
Well, that's not been an uncommon pattern. You had the last few recoveries began, they were called jobless recoveries, and then they started adding jobs along the way, and then they looked kind of wageless to many of us. And in many ways, what we're really talking about here is the evolving gap between overall economic growth or productivity growth, basically the kind of macroeconomic growth numbers that an economy posts as it expands year to year, and the living standards of middle and low income families. They've been lagging behind productivity growth for decades now, and that begs the question as to why, and that takes you right into the inequality discussion. It's a longer discussion, but I guess I'd summarize it this way. The disconnect between overall economic growth and the living standards of most households has a lot to do with problems in the job market, the lack of bargaining power for middle and low-income people, the lack of availability of higher-quality jobs, jobs that used to return a pretty reliable living wage to people. So I look at this very much as kind of an unbalanced growth pattern.
Now, of course, there are many explanations for the increase in inequality over the last several decades. What's your preferred one?
I think that I can't remember. It might have been Barry Bluestone who coined this "murder on the Orient Express" explanation. There's not one perp. There's just a bunch. The usual list is globalization, increased employer skill demands. The declining unionization, lower minimum wages, these all play a role. But in fact, I have two that I favor. One that I think is the most important and interestingly somewhat overlooked, even though it's kind of staring you in the face, is the absence of full employment. Full employment is a situation where the unemployment rate is very low, the job market's very tight, and what that does is it helps to ensure that the benefits of growth are much more broadly shared. Even in an economy with lots of technical change and lots of globalization like ours, in the second half of the 1990s, when the job market was very tight, we actually saw the wages of even low wage workers growing at the rate of productivity there for at least a New York minute. So that's one. Number two would be just the financialization of the American economy, particularly in the 2000s, which is really a lousy year for job growth and income growth, middle class poverty. What we really saw there was more and more economic resources devoted to kind of sloshing around at the top in financial markets in ways that proved to be not particularly productive and quite volatile in terms of the macro economy. So I would argue those forces are very important.
Full employment, I think there's some people who say it would be nearly impossible to imagine getting back there. Do you think that's possible?
You know, it's funny you should say that because I've been thinking about that very question this morning. I kind of think that's correct, that absent pretty aggressive public policy, I'm quite concerned that we won't create, that the market left to itself won't create enough employment to meet the quantity of job seekers. Basically, you'll have a disequilibrium, a structural mismatch between the amount of job seekers and the amount of jobs. And that was the case, by the way. Of course, that's the case right now, but it's very cyclical. That's just largely a function of the Great Recession. So it's hard to pull out what's cyclical and what's more embedded in the longer-term economy. But if you actually look over the decade of the 2000s, when the economy was expanding, we had a very lousy job creation record. And it's true that this financialization dynamic was in place, and I think that hurt a lot. As I said, I think that's a way to create output, but not very lasting, and not with a lot of jobs. But I think we're going to have to seriously consider, not going back to the 30s New Deal and send a bunch of people into the woods to build a dam. that's not the way it's going to work. But I do think we're going to have to consider ways to create more employment than the market itself will deliver, and that will be a role for public policy.
Which, of course, is pretty verboten to talk about these days, isn't it?
Well, you and I just talked about it.
Okay. And I'm sure the listeners, many listeners would agree. I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. Well, of course, the Republican presidential candidate was in the news recently for saying some harsh things about half the American population. They just don't pay taxes. What do you make of his claim?
Well, I think you have to be the first thing that I'd love to stress here, and this is not about so much candidates or partisanship or horse races, just facts. I think one of the things that's coming out of this is this notion that 46% or 47% of the population doesn't pay any taxes, and that is just flat out wrong. There are 46% who don't pay federal income tax, and that number is elevated because of the recession. It's usually down around 40 or so. But just because you don't pay federal income tax doesn't mean you don't pay taxes. If you have a job, you pay payroll taxes, and it turns out that 28% of that 46, so about 60% of the non-taxpayers, non-federal income taxpayers, are paying payroll taxes, so that means they're working. But it goes much further than that. If you ever put gas in the tank of your car, you're paying a tax. If you live in a state with a sales tax, you're paying a tax. If you live in a state with an income tax, you're paying a tax. So the first thing I'd want to point out is that factual point that far more people actually contribute to tax revenues than that quote would suggest.
You mentioned 28% of those folks are paying payroll taxes. Who else are the non-income taxpayers?
There's about, I think, I can't remember exactly the number, but about 7% of that 46, so, you know, something like 15% or so, after the standard deduction, they don't have any federal income tax liability because their income is so low. So if you're someone who's got a family and maybe $20,000 or $30,000, and maybe you get the earned income tax credit, which is a wage subsidy for low-income workers, and you take the standard deduction, your tax liability gets wiped out. So those are just low-income people who are kind of playing by the rules, and their incomes are too low to have a tax deduction in what's still a somewhat progressive system. And then 10% of that 46 are elderly people with modest incomes and no earnings. So if you kind of break it down, it's hard to really find much substance at all in that argument.
And what about hedge fund guys who shelter all their income?
So that's the other thing. That's the other part of this that I actually wrote about yesterday. I pointed out, for example, that in 2009, which is the most recent data, according to the IRS, there are 21,000 tax returns with incomes above $200,000 that had no federal income tax liability. So, you know, 21,000 out of over 100 million tax returns is not a large group by any stretch of the imagination. But I used it kind of just to point out that there are lots of people at the top end of the income scale, and by the way, that would include, you know, Democrats like Warren Buffett and Republicans like Mitt Romney, who, because of the composition of their income and the fact that so much of it is non-wage, unearned, what we call non-labor income, things like capital gains from selling your assets or incomes from your bond portfolio, all that sort of thing is treated very favorably by the tax code, and that's why you have these guys paying tax rates that are in the 13-15% range, which is oftentimes lower than that people with incomes who are a tiny fraction of theirs pay.
And a very large portion of the population pays more in, even among those who pay income tax, pay higher payroll taxes than they do income taxes. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. That would be something like 80 or 90%.
So the Social Security tax is rather substantial for most people.
Right. I mean, if you look at the payroll tax, which is the Social Security tax or Medicare tax, that is the largest portion of the federal tax for something like 80 or 90% of families, as I just mentioned. And that tax, by the way, is not progressive at all. That the share of your income that you pay in that tax, in the payroll tax, actually goes down as your income goes up.
Because it's capped at a certain...
It's just a flat percentage, yeah.
Up to a certain point, though, then it gets...
And then it goes away at about, around $110,000, it disappears. If you actually look at the percentage of income that people pay in payroll taxes, for middle-income families, it's about 9%. For families in the top 1%, whose average income is well over $1 million, it's about 2%. So they're paying far less in payroll taxes as a share of their income than anybody else. So that one part of the tax code is actually quite regressive.
And then, of course, people are paying state and local taxes. Property and sales taxes are not insignificant in a lot of states, right?
That's right. If you look at state and local taxes, and that includes state income taxes, sales taxes, things like that, the share of your income that you pay in state and local taxes actually declines as your income goes up. So that's kind of the definition of a regressive tax code as opposed to a more progressive one. If we were talking about the federal income tax, it goes the other way. So if you're in the bottom fifth of the income scale, you pay about 12% of your income in state and local taxes. If you're in the middle, you pay about 11, and if you're at the top, if you're in the top 1%, you pay about 8%. So just to be clear, a lot of numbers there, about 12% of your income, if you're in the bottom fifth, that's your taxes, as a state and local taxes as a share of your income, and about 8% if you're in the top 1%. So it kind of goes down as your income goes up.
And of course, allegedly low-taxed states like Texas are among the worst of all, right?
Well, I mean, there's this kind of gets to the nub of this thing, which underlying the whole discussion, and we talk about it much too infrequently, is the implicit notion, I argue fairly widely accepted by Republicans and Democrats, that taxes are bad, that taxes are just something to always cut, never to raise, always to be avoided. There's nothing good about them. All they do is distort the economy and don't help anyone. And of course, as your comment about low-tax states suggests, that's just nonsense. I mean, I'm not saying that there's never any waste of tax dollars, and that's something we should absolutely stamp out. But the fact is, I think it was Elizabeth Warren says this, and President Obama kind of tried to follow along with this, we wouldn't have a functional economy without the investments that we make from public revenues. We wouldn't have, our entrepreneurs and employers wouldn't have an educated workforce. They wouldn't have a productive infrastructure. And in fact, as we've been so viciously and asymmetrically approaching tax policy, and by that I mean always cut, never raise, I would argue that those fundamental economic inputs from infrastructure to research and development to energy to education are all under threat because we have such a terrible understanding of the role of taxation in an advanced economy.
Now, when Romney said these things, he was, of course, pandering to rich donors. But what would the policy implications be of what he was saying? Does he want to increase taxes in the bottom half of the population? What do you suppose he's got in mind?
That's an interesting point. I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around a lot of this stuff. I mean, the Governor Romney has said that he wants to cut taxes. So, and actually, if you look at the reason why lots of people don't have a federal income tax liability, I mentioned this a few comments ago. Part of it has to do with the fact that people with low incomes have these deductions. They can deduct some of their tax liability from their income, and they have tax credits like this earned income tax credit. Now, this is a wage subsidy, very pro-work, and beloved of Republicans. Ronald Reagan called this the best anti-poverty program out there. In fact, I kind of agree with him. It is a very effective way to take low-wage jobs and get them closer to living-wage jobs. It's a wage subsidy that can mean $4,000 or $5,000 to a low-income family over the course of a year. And that is a credit against your tax liability, and it's one of the reasons why you see why you have people not paying federal income taxes. So, again, I don't really want to get into the politics of what Governor Romney said, because, you know, A, I don't, and I'm thinking about this more as a policy person, and B, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, there's nothing there in terms of really, really substance. But I think at the end of the day, where I come out is this idea that, that you can run a functioning, contemporary, global, world-class economy without tax revenue is nuts, A, and B, the idea that you can cut the heck out of the tax base and you know, double down. I mean, not only accept and make permanent the Bush tax cuts, but add another $4.5 trillion on top of that, which is the Romney-Ryan plan, is just supply side trickle down fairy dust. So I worry very much about this whole line of argument.
And finally, I mean, it sounds like you think that we need to get taxes up. We're collecting about, what, 16% of GDP at the federal level, below 3 points or so below its long-term historical average. Is 19 enough? And how do we get it back up there in a humane and stimulative way?
Yeah, so those are good questions. Those are very good questions. Let me answer the second first and then come back to the what's enough question. What share of GDP should we be collecting in revenue? I think the important thing in terms of collecting more revenue is to start with the president's idea, which is supported by Senate Democrats as well, to allow the high-end Bush tax cuts to finally expire. I'm not particularly worried about that, even in an economy that's not growing quickly enough like our own, because any sort of multiplier effect off of those very high-income folks who aren't income-constrained in the first place is not particularly large. It tends to be quite small. So I don't worry about the kind of macroeconomic impact of allowing the Bush tax cuts to sunset, say, next year. I wouldn't go much further than that in the near term, but eventually I believe that we're going to have to collect more revenue, and not just from households whose incomes are above $250,000. I think that that idea just ultimately won't work. And in fact, when I look back to the Clinton years and the tax structure that prevailed in those years, where we were collecting somewhere in the historical average range, 18-19% of revenue, those were perfectly fine years in terms of the impact of the tax structure on growth, on jobs, on middle incomes, on productivity. We talked about that a little bit earlier in terms of the full employment economy of the latter 90s. So I'd probably ultimately slide back into that kind of a tax structure, but I'd phase it in.
And how would you feel about some sort of consumption tax, a VAT or something like that?
Oh, that doesn't really get me all that excited. Like I said, I'm pretty comfortable with the tax structure that prevailed in the Clinton years. I mean, economists like consumption taxes because they're believed to be less distortionary, and you know, I get that. I don't see nearly all the distortions in the tax code that other people worry about. It just empirically, it doesn't quite seem to show up that way, and it. You know, design a consumption tax so it's not regressive, that is, if you look at middle and low-income families, they consume most of their income. High-income families save most of their income. So you have to worry about the regressivity of a consumption tax, and that means you have to structure it in ways to offset that. So it can be done, and I think it's okay, but I wouldn't get too wound up about it. Let me speak to your question briefly about what percent of GDP we should collect. First of all, I don't want to go on record here as saying all I think we should do is increase taxes. I do believe we need more revenue than we're collecting, and that's not just a slow-growing economy. That's also a structure of the tax code. I wrote an op-ed about this for the Financial Times a few weeks ago. If people want to try to find that on this point, but I also think that spending needs to be on the table, and I think it's fair to. To take a bit of a whack at both sides of the budget in that regard. I would never put a cap on either revenues or outlays. I really don't like these policies that say we're going to lock in 20% of spending and we're going to lock in X percent of revenue. It's just impossible. You just don't know what the future holds. Larry Summers had a good and provocative op-ed in the Washington Post a few weeks ago where he said just based on the aging of the population and I think some reasonable forecast for where medical costs are going, you'd be hard-pressed to lock in any kind of spending cap at a historical rate. We have an older We have an older demographic that's going to demand more health care, et cetera. But we don't know what's around the corner. We don't know what kind of external threats there are, whether it's environmental or geopolitical. So locking things in, you have to be more flexible than that. I don't think it makes sense to say this is what we need to collect and stop there. I think we need to have enough government revenue collected in the most efficient way to meet the challenges of an advanced 21st century economy like ours. I mean, I can say a lot more about that. That's probably a whole other discussion, but that's I think the right way to think about it.
That was Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the second movement of the first piano sonata by Pierre Boulez, performed by Edel Beret. Till next week, bye. Thank you.